For many of us, that's music to our ears. Gorillaz, happy, content, playing. In fact, Gorillaz, you just say the word and people's imaginations immediately kick into gear. Of all the great apes, they seem to hold a unique place, a special fascination in our minds. But ask folks what gorillaz do that's so captivating? Silence. It's something intangibly intrinsic, almost beyond words. I know I feel it. Hi, I'm your host, Jerry Ellis, and welcome to Season 3 of Talking Apes. Amazingly, as much as we feel and we think we know about gorillaz, one kind, even today, remains a mystery. Ironically, it's the largest of all gorillaz, the Eastern Lowland Gorilla, or Grauer's Gorilla. Frighteningly, Grauer's Gorilla's numbers have plummeted by 80% over the last 20 years. And only 6,800 individuals remain. We're tiptoeing dangerously close to losing this huge, majestic ape. At the current rate of decline, within 10 years, they could be extinct. So can this largest of all great apes survive this decade and beyond? We'll try to sort that out with my next guest, Dr. Katie Fawcett, the program's director of GRACE, the Gorilla Rehabilitation Conservation Education Nonprofit, based in the Democratic Republic of Congo. As we kick off Season 3 of Talking Apes, we're also celebrating World Gorilla Day. And I could think of no one better than Katie Fawcett to help us understand what it takes to save a gorilla species. She spent a decade managing the Karasoke Research Center in the mountains of Rwanda for the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund International, building a working knowledge of on-the-ground gorilla conservation in Africa. Katie is an experienced conservation biologist, now leading GRACE's animal welfare and conservation programming. You're listening to Talking Apes, the podcast that gets to the heart of what's happening with and to apes like us. Talking Apes is made possible through the generous support of listeners like you and through our growing Patreon members program. For as little as $3 a month, we invite you to join those who have committed to making this podcast a growing global success. To support Talking Apes, start by visiting our website at talkingapes.org. That's talkingapes.org. And now, my conversation with GRACE's Katie Fawcett. Hi, Katie. Welcome to Talking Apes. I am so delighted to have you here with us to help celebrate World Gorilla Day and launch our third season. But first, let me say, I am amazed we have never met, considering we both have spent decades in the gorilla world of Central Africa. It is such a pleasure to finally say hello.
Thank you, Jerry. It's wonderful to meet you too.
We're going to be talking about Grauer's gorillas today. And people know about gorillas, mostly mountain gorillas, because that's, you know, Diane Fossey and all of that kind of thing. And then the gorilla that most people see when they go to a zoo is a Western Lowland Gorilla, which comes from the western part of Equatorial Africa. But you're working at GRACE with Grauer's Gorillas, which are, I don't think anybody even knows they exist. And yet it's the biggest primate on the planet. They're over 6 feet tall, 2 meters, and they can weigh 450 to 500 plus pounds. So maybe tell us a little bit about what a grower is and...
Yeah, absolutely, Joe. Yeah, you're right. Grauer's gorillas, or they're also known as Eastern Lowland gorillas, are only found in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. So that's their habitat. That's their range. There are two species of gorillas, as you said, the Western gorillas and the Eastern species. And they separated in the last ice age when the equatorial forests retreated. The forests have now regrown, but the two species have yet to meet again. So there's about 900 kilometers of forest between the Western Lowland gorillas and the Eastern species of gorillas. And then within the Eastern species, there's two populations. The mountain gorillas, as you say, that are really well known through the movies like Gorillas in the Mist, Diane Fossey, and those of us that have been lucky enough to visit mountain gorillas. I think they're the only place you can realistically easily visit gorillas in the wild. And then there's the Grauwes gorillas in Eastern DRC, or Democratic Republic of Congo. And they're kind of in these remote forests, which are hard to access. They've had significant less attention for research, for conservation, for tourism, over time. But as you say, they're incredibly important, and an iconic species, and really a huge source of pride also for the Congolese.
Yeah, it's the thing that I think that's a challenge about growers also is the fact that mountains are almost, they're almost trapped in this wildlife game park on those mountains, where growers are living in these much more expansive forests, which makes it much, I would guess, much more difficult to see them. And one of the reasons that tourism maybe has not caught up with them the same way it has with mountain gorillas. But it also makes it a lot more difficult to do conservation because of that.
Yeah. Maybe
you could talk about just the challenge of understanding this species a little bit.
Yeah. So if we go back a little bit in history, the first surveys of growers were about the same time as we were learning about mountain gorillas, with Scholler in the late 50s, early 60s. And even at that time, Scholler was reporting that numbers were in rapid decline, because this area of the world not only has these most amazing and incredible forests and high biodiversity conservation areas, it also has a very high human population. So the pressures on these huge forests right at the eastern edge of the Congo Basin are huge. We have a lot of urban centers, a lot of growing, very fast growing urban centers, along the Rift Valley, that's creating pressure on these, on the forest resources and the wildlife within. Continued in the 90s. And during that time, populations which were observed in Charlotte's times had gone extinct in that period. So the decline was continuing. And then from the 90s until now, that whole region has just been experiencing the most incredible, devastating conflict, human conflict. And that has made conservation, access to these forests, work in that area challenging, beyond challenging, hugely difficult. Getting accurate information on the status of the growers population during this time has been difficult. What's clear is that growers, gorillas, like both gorilla species, Western lowland and Eastern species, are critically endangered, and their numbers are declining. And so our challenge as conservationists is to address that challenge and to look for solutions. And how we turn that situation into a conservation success.
One of the problems that consistently pops up when dealing with especially primates, it seems like in my conversations with conservationists and people working on conservation, is we simply just don't know how many of something exists. I mean, accurate population counts seem to be one of the most difficult things in this part of the world to get, you know, especially accurate enough to start doing conservation plans. What kind of numbers are we talking about with growers, and how accurate are they?
Yeah, so I think you're right, Jerry. And I think the last decade, or a little bit more than the last decade, has been spent trying to get numbers. So there's been a lot of field surveys throughout the growers range to better understand what the numbers are right now, to provide that baseline for monitoring over time. I think it's clear the numbers are decreasing. And our estimate right now is 6,800 individuals. I'd say our estimate right now is much better than it has been for decades. I think this survey work was a key reason for Grace. As you know, Grace was set up as a gorilla sanctuary to pivot to conservation work. Because during the success of establishing the sanctuary over those 10 years, the field scientists conducting surveys, the picture that was coming out was really bleak on the decline of those numbers. And Grace is situated right next to wild gorilla habitat. So it's an ideal location to expand our scope to conservation of gorillas in the wild. And as you said, Jerry, these places are extremely remote and difficult to work in. So not only are they remote by the fact that the survey teams walk for day by day. When you look at a budget for a survey, when I first came in and looked at a budget for that, I'm like, where's the transportation line? And the team was like, it's there, Katie, boots. No vehicle transportation beyond Grace. It's all done by foot, days and days of walking by foot. So that's remote to access these fast. But these communities, the local communities where the gorillas are located are also remote, have a history of violent conflict, and disruption over the last few decades. And very, as a result of that, very, xenophobic. And it can be difficult to access these areas to be able to understand what's going on, and let alone to be able to then implement successful conservation measures. So I think one of the main successes for Grace over the last 10 years establishing the sanctuary was establishing trust in that community that we work with. And from that very, very solid foundation of trust, being able to then work with the local communities to, first of all, conduct the first survey for nearly two decades in the Taina Nature Reserve, and then to build on that hand in hand with the communities charged with their conservation to implement ongoing monitoring and protection programs in the area.
I think the trust issue is a big one, and I want to talk about that a little bit more, because prior to us starting the recording for the podcast, we were talking about the fact that you have, Grace is also fairly unique in that everybody on the ground there is Congolese. You know, this isn't a bunch of expats running a sanctuary and with a few Congolese that are cleaning out cages or something. This is a very different approach. So I want to get into that. But that 6,800 animals that we think are there, over what kind of range is that?
Yeah, it's really interesting with the Grawis gorilla. Their distribution's really patchy. And it had been even back when Shola did the surveys in the late 50s. So you have like pockets, if you like, of Grawis gorilla populations throughout that area in eastern DRC. So yeah, that makes it more challenging in the sense that the location is more widespread across different provinces, across different ethnic communities. They're also the most widest variation in their altitudinal distribution. So I think one of the main reasons for changing, using the name Eastern Lowland Gorilla to Grawis Gorilla is that the lowland bit is a bit of a misnomer. So the gorillas actually range in the Kavuzi-Biriga Highlands. Mount Chimborumo in Virunga National Park is of a higher altitude, similar to some of the altitude with mountain gorillas. And then they go right down into the start of the Congo Basin and the lowland gorilla habitat, the lowland forest, which is much more similar to the habitat of the western lowland gorillas. So we don't have as much information on their behavior or their diet. We don't have the same amount of gorillas that it has been habituated for research or tourism. That's their use to human presence, so we can actually observe what gorillas are doing. The work we do at Grace now, we follow gorillas, but from one day behind. So we're observing gorilla feeding trails. We're not observing gorillas. We're observing gorillas' nests where they were the night before, but we're not observing gorillas. We do a lot of work on gorilla dung sample. They're very varied, but this is to try and understand the variation in their diet, perhaps over time and behavior between these different isolated populations within the Grawis range. And that word isolated is another important word. We've got to ensure that these scattered groups remain connected.
I was just going to ask how much a connection is there, because otherwise you're going to start looking at genetic issues. And
yeah. And that's what we're facing with the small population in Mount Chibirimu in the Virunga National Park. Their numbers are down to just 7 individuals. Where Shana did their exploration in the late 50s, the forests were almost contiguous across to where we are at Grace. There were other little populations of gorillas along the way that have now been
extirpated.
Yeah, so I've been lost, and that's just simply from human pressure. So it's, we know, Jerry, around the world, human population is growing. And that growing population needs land for agriculture, needs charcoal for cooking, it needs wood for construction. And even in Charlotte's day, he was noting the conflict with local populations through crop raiding as the gorillas are coming more and more in close contact with people. So trying to find this balance between human needs and conserving gorillas, I think, is going to be key to success. It is for conservation everywhere. So I think we need to really focus in on the local situation and local solutions for where we're working. So that's going to be kind of a bit wide-ranging from the initial.
And then on top of that, the other conservation issue there becomes, this is one of the most mineral-rich places on the planet.
Yeah.
Some people listening might have heard of things like coltan or tantalite and things that are in their cell phones. On your website, you actually have some information about the impact of those minerals and cell phones on gorillas. A fact that I came across a few years ago, which was kind of stunned me, was the uranium that was used in the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in World War II actually came from this part of the world.
Yeah.
It was mined. So it's this mining of minerals and ores has been going on for decades and decades and decades. And it all has an impact on not only the landscape, but the people's lives there. And
yeah, you're right, Jerry. And I think in the area we work, gold is the main mineral. And it's mining. It's mainly artisanal mining. So that has, as you say, some direct destruction of the forest. People that are doing the mining, it's not like a high income activity, driven by necessity of paying school fees, paying healthcare often. But when people go and mine in the forest, they're taken away from their fields. They're taken away from any other source of food. And so hunting is a major issue in areas of eastern DRC associated with the artisanal mining.
Well, let's talk a little bit about GRACE and what GRACE is. It's an acronym, first of all. So maybe you can talk about that. But describe this place that is physically GRACE on the ground in Congo.
So, maybe we describe the journey to get there. So from the nearest city where you can fly into Goma, international flights or regional flights or overland travel into country. And then a small plane journey to Butembo, the next nearest town. Then a day's travel by road. And at the end of the road, that's where the GRACE facility lies. What's exciting for me whenever I look at the maps is that end of the road is the start of the vast Congo Basin. So it's right there on the edge, which I just find wildly exciting. GRACE was created, as Nakumas has said, it's gorilla rehabilitation and conservation education. So it was really, it's always been focused on gorillas and focused on a conservation strategy. So always on the fact that, you know, every individual counts, the numbers of such gorillas. And so providing a space for gorilla rehabilitation with the eventual goal of rewilding or releasing gorillas back into their natural habitat. So the facility itself is amazing. It's there in this remote Congo Basin, built to GFAS standards, which is the Global Federation of Accredited Sanctuaries. It houses currently a family of 14 Grawitz gorillas, and it includes these two huge forest enclosures or habitats. And really the goal there is to make sure those 14 gorillas have those survival critical skills for release back into the world. So that's been able to socialize, be a member of a gorilla family, but also like just simply learning how to choose the right foods to eat, how to build a nest at night. So that's a facility. And then from that, over the last few years, we've been growing into the work that we do in the, with local communities and community-led conservation.
And we will have a blog that will accompany this podcast. And on there, we'll have a map of the region and we'll have some links to your site. Because what's wonderful, I think, about what you guys are doing there is you have, there's a lot of cameras and things. So people can actually go and watch the gorillas, even though they can't visit there or it's difficult to visit there. We'll definitely talk about that in a few minutes. But I think the other thing that's interesting about the site when you see some of this imagery from there, you get the impression is you, like you said, you have these big enclosures, but they abut the forest. So
exactly.
In a sense of you could almost just take down the fences along one extent of it and the gorillas could just walk into the rest of the forest. Because, I mean, their enclosures are a big chunk of forest to start with. But so that opportunity for them to actually go back in the wild. Most of the gorillas there, if I remember, were all from poaching incidents. They were rescued and they were all pretty little when they first came, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Jerry.
So, what are their age? What kind of ages and stuff now, so people have some idea of what this place looks like?
Yeah, so yeah, you're absolutely right. They usually come into our care under 3 years of age. So that's the age that they would still be 100% reliant on their mother for care. Our goal at Grace has been to immediately, once stabilized over a few weeks, or a month, is to immediately integrate the infants into the gorilla family because nobody knows how best to raise a gorilla than a gorilla. And we've been incredibly successful with that first step so far. It's a very large family, 14 gorillas to be housed together. But those gorillas have grown up over the time. So we now have three mature males, one silverback, two blackbacks, verging on becoming silverbacks. So they're in their mid to late teens. We have some of the females are over 20 years old now, and our youngest, Nulingu, is now a sub-adult female. So yeah, the gorillas are maturing in the family.
So it's if she's a sub-adult female, that means you haven't gotten in any growlers in recent years. Is that because poaching has died off, or is it just there aren't any?
It's just really hard to say, Jerry. We have not had as many reports or incidences of gorilla poaching. We had during COVID, there was an increase in poaching for other great ape sanctuaries. In Congo with bonobos, with chimpanzees. We didn't see that with the gorillas. I think their numbers are far fewer to begin with in the wild. So it's hard to really understand if that poaching pressure's decreased or the number of gorillas has decreased in the wild. I think it, at least in the areas where we're working, very close by, we're seeing less reports or any reports of poaching of gorillas, which is very, as you can see, I hesitate to be positive. Yeah, because we have to always be on our toes and
So Katie, are the gorillas that were poached, was it bushmeat and killing larger gorillas and then as a byproduct these babies were there, or were they actually poached? Do we think they were poached as babies to actually sell into some kind of pet trade or some other thing?
I think, you know, it's hard to know, Jerry. You just find the baby. I think we do know for every baby gorilla, the family most likely was killed. So unlike chimps that might scatter during a poaching attack to other corners, the role of that huge silverback gorilla is protection. So he'll come forward, the other members group around him. So it's quite fair to say, I think, with every infant, that's a whole gorilla family that's being poached. My understanding is that it's likely poaching for meat for food, and that the insulin is then a byproduct of that. And then as a byproduct, it might be, there might be an attempt to sell through the illegal wildlife trade, which we know is rampant in Eastern DRC, or sometimes as a mascot for rebel groups, armed groups in the area. But I think fundamentally likely for meat originally.
I am so delighted to have Katie Fawcett here to get Talking Apes off to a great start for season 3, as well as helping us celebrate World Gorilla Day, September 24th. When we come back to the conversation, I want to explore with Katie how her experience with mountain gorillas has impacted her work at Grace. But before we get to that, I want to welcome back assistant producer Demel Zaban. She's been out on podcast holiday, you might say, and she's got all kinds of new news to share with us about what we're doing here at Talking Apes. Hi, Demelza.
Hiya, Jerry. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to season 3. Did you miss us? We've had a really busy summer working on some of our other ape conservation programs, but we're so pleased to be back and kicking off this season with the fabulous Katie to celebrate World Gorilla Day. Thanks to all of you who tuned in last season, we hit some mega milestones. 10,000 downloads across 100 countries, and that number just keeps growing. We're actually really proud because we read the other day that 90% of podcasters quit after the third episode, and only 1% make it past 20 episodes. So we're on episode 46 now, snugly wedged into that 1%. So thank you, listeners, for your support. Big exciting news for you all today. We have finally launched our official Talking Apes merch store. So many of you have asked us when we were going to do this. So you can buy t-shirts with our logo, or lovely cozy jumpers, or sweaters if you're listening from the US. All profits from sales will go directly to our non-profit Globio, through which we run this podcast, our Ape Cycles YouTube channel, and our other great ape protection programs. So head over to talkingapes.org and look for the merch button at the top of the page. Also up there, you'll find the link for Patreon, through which you can become a Talking Apes troop member for a small monthly donation. Members get a shout out on the show, exclusive updates, and we'll be offering all patrons a sneaky discount code for the merch. So come and join our troop today if you want the goodies. As always, big love to our existing supporters who are the backbone of this podcast and keep us swinging through the trees. Quick couple of reviews because I'm talking a lot. Mary said, I love your podcast and learning about apes. Karen said, I subscribe to it on Spotify so I can listen while I'm doing my housework. Thank you for the wonderful content. We're so lucky to have such lovely words of encouragement. Speaking of subscribing, please do that wherever you're listening. Leave us a like, or especially if you're an Apple user, leave us a 5-star rating. It takes a couple of seconds and it really helps us to get more visibility. As a non-profit, we don't have a huge advertising budget or anything like that, so we really rely on reviews and people sharing this with their friends to help us get the word out. Don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on all the main platforms. Search Talking Apes, or you can also follow Apes Like Us to learn about our other programs. Keep the reviews, comments, and questions coming in, and don't forget to check out our merch stall. I'm going to let you get back to this fascinating talk about protecting the magnificent growers now. So back to Katie and Jerry in the studio.
Many thanks, Demelza. And now back to my conversation with Katie Fawcett. Katie, Grace is not that far as the crow flies from where you worked for over a decade, saving another critically endangered ape, the mountain gorillas in the Virunga Mountains of Rwanda. One of the things I'm curious about is the application of this concept called extreme conservation, which has enabled gorilla numbers there to grow like no other ape. And I'm wondering, does it have a role to play in what you're doing in DRC? there must be enormous lessons that you learned from that concept of extreme conservation and the approaches and the experience that you can draw on for grace. Can you take a few minutes and just walk us through that?
Yeah, thank you, Jerry. I think that's really important. And I think it's really important that for us as guerrilla conservationists understand that focus on individuals, that daily protection and monitoring, was so key to the success of the increase in the mountain gorilla population. And I think Grace is well positioned to extend that thought process from the intense care that we give, that we provide to the gorillas in the sanctuary, to then look at how we take that every individual counts approach to conservation in these vast landscapes. So it's not enough just to focus on forest protection, or whilst that's incredibly important, we need to, gorilla conservationists, go deeper and focus on the individual gorilla families and within these forest environments. So at Grace, what that meant is that when we had the results of the survey, we were able to see where there were areas of intent, higher density of gorilla groups, and we've set up monitoring teams in that area. So we actually have monitoring teams just for one gorilla group at the moment, but they provide 24/7 monitoring protection to that gorilla group. And we hope that by having that presence in the forest in this area of high density, that also can help provide protection to other groups. But I think it's that really intense focus on individual gorilla groups, individual monitoring, if we can do this through the genetics or the DNA, really understanding things on that micro level, if you like, which makes gorilla conservation a little bit different, maybe from some other conservation models.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you if you thought that extreme conservation approach, do you see perhaps in some of these areas the same kinds of things where, you know, with the mountain gorillas, you have the gorilla doctors. So they're mm-hmm. I mean, let me rephrase that a little bit. Almost every gorilla in the Virungas and Bawindi now sees people every day. I mean, there are babies that are born there mm-hmm. who have never spent a day without seeing a human being in some form, national park yeah. ranger, visitors, gorilla doctors, you know, something. Do you see that kind of extreme conservation being the success model ultimately for growers?
I think going back to technology, we can utilize technology for a different. I don't think tourism, I don't think habituation and daily monitoring is the solution for growers conservation. We partnered with gorilla doctors during the Taina survey to collect fecal samples to trial methods for remote health monitoring. Through fecal samples, which I think is something. We're also trialing the use of camera traps. I think that's got a huge amount of potential for monitoring at scale and acoustic monitoring too. So I think we take that philosophy of that intensive monitoring, but it may look different on how that's
implemented. That's interesting. Yeah, I think acoustic, it's interesting. This is a whole nother podcast, but the acoustic monitoring is something that in Cameroon, I met a gentleman who was doing acoustic monitoring where the Cross River gorillas are, and that area, they were, he was setting up there to monitor for poaching as well, because from acoustic monitoring, when they heard gunshots go off, they could actually tell the caliber of the guns that were being used. But then they were hearing chainsaws and other things yeah. with their acoustic monitoring. Yeah. So yeah, the technology application is an interesting one. So
yeah, and I think there's been advancements for acoustic monitoring. One of our science advisors works with acoustic monitoring with the silverback chesapeake. So there's potential there specific to monitoring gorillas themselves, not just the threats.
Wow.
And now our next project is trying to put in these remote field stations so we can have that internet connectivity and electrical charging facilities in the field rather than having our teams having to make that journey back and forth to Grace and have that data just go straight to the cloud where we'll use our AI to help process that data So I think technology is going to really help with collecting and processing this data, but we need to maintain that focus on gorillas and what gorillas need. And, you know, as you started right out, the Apache distribution, we need to understand their diet. We need to understand, you know, what do we need to protect? What do we need to protect for the gorilla survival? What's their diet in Taina? Diet we're collecting from seeding observations right now. How much space do they need? You know, we have home range size from high altitude populations in Cuyuzi Biega or mountain gorillas, but that's really different habitat. So, you know, what's needed in this area in Taina? So all this very basic biology is actually fundamental to conservation and that focus.
And the bigger conservation issue, which is if you don't protect this space, you'll never know all that information. Before it gets destroyed, it's got to be protected.
Yeah, it's got to be protected. We've got to make sure we don't end up with empty forests. And I think that's where that gorilla focus comes in, more important.
Katie, Grace is very different, and it's not by accident. It's different in many respects from any other primate sanctuary that I've seen anywhere across sub-Saharan Africa. Can you talk about that a little bit and how that difference was envisioned from the very start?
I think the thinking from the beginning was that Grace would be a sanctuary for gorillas, not a wildlife sanctuary in general, but a specific response for the conservation authorities management, the national government authorities charged with conservation. What would you say? That were responding to the wildlife crime, but had nowhere to house these individuals. And none of the wildlife sanctuaries at that time were caring for gorillas. And gorillas really needed specific support. Gorillas are incredibly sensitive. As I mentioned before, they're coming at a time when they would still be 100% with their mother. They tend to be incredibly sensitive. And through my work at Karasoki, I was involved with the rescue of orphan gorillas when they first came into the organization's care. And really that first week, it's really the gorillas deciding to live. So you can give it all the medical attention. Everything can be available. But really, psychologically, they're incredibly sensitive. So being able to set up a care support system specifically for this critically endangered species, we're seen as a priority. And as I mentioned before, it's always been part of a conservation strategy to be able to have a population of this critically endangered species ready for release into the wild when appropriate. So securing for healthy forests is a number one priority for conservation in the region.
Let's talk about securing that forest. Grace is a piece of that forest and it backs right up to forest. What does that take in this part of the world? It's so violent and constantly violent. And then you have on top of it, things like Ebola outbreaks. And it just seems like trying to run a secure piece of land, like a park we would normally think of in our brains as a park, is just, it's such a foreign concept. That how do you begin to work that piece of the conservation puzzle? Because that seems like a very fundamental thing. If you can't secure the landscape for the species.
I think, Jerry, you hit the nail on the head there, secure the landscape. And I think one of Grace's successes is due to the very, very strong community organization in the region. So in DRC, in addition to, local government administration, there's still a very strong system of traditional authorities and management of land. And actually, the Taina Nature Reserve, which is adjacent to Grace, was really set up with the dual goals of securing land rights for the local population, in addition to protecting biodiversity. Gorillas and chimpanzees and kapi in the area. And actually the local community, the traditional Mwami or the head of the local community organization, saw conservation as a methodology, if you like, for success for his community. So through the process of the creation of Taina Nature Reserve, the land for the creation was donated by 21 families within the kingdom. We call them Barazas, 21 Barazas donated land. And through the donation of the land for the creation of the nature reserve, they secured their rights to manage that land. So they are now charged with the protection of the forest in that area. And that also secures their rights for the cultural significance of that area and their ownership of that area, and to continue to benefit from the forest in that area. And this is a model which has kind of slightly been adapted, but which has been adapted, but based on the same concept, which we're working with for expanding a corridor to provide connectivity between the Taina Nature Reserve and the Maiko National Park. So there, this system now within the Congolese legislation called Community Forest Concessions. And it works on the same basis that by securing land rights for communities, they then have a decision how they manage their forest. And this really promotes community ownership and leadership over the management of the forest. So that's a system that GRACE works hard to support the local leadership in conservation and management of these resources, and looking for solutions that will benefit both the challenges facing people in that area and also provide protection to the gorillas in the forest that they call home.
I guess the first question that pops to mind, Katie, is you've got these 21 barazas, and they, what does security of this forest mean to them? From a Western standpoint, we're looking at it, I'm guessing, primarily from the gorillas or the wildlife. We're going, okay, this is there to protect them. And we know that that exclusionary approach to conservation just does not work. It's, you know, it's been tried in many places around the planet. And you just can't throw people out of land that they've been on for their entire existence. And but at the same time, if they see the land as a place I go hunt, they see the place as I do slash and burn agriculture, that's not necessarily, especially with these diminishing populations of critically endangered species like a grower, that's not in concert long term. So how does that work? Let's talk about it just from a GRACE standpoint, for example. How does that work? Is it purely an education process, or how are you getting 21 communities to see security as not just using up that landscape and using up the wildlife that exists in it?
Yeah, I think that's the challenge, Jerry. And I'm not sure anybody has any direct answers on how to solve that. What we do know is that when you do global analysis of forest protection, land under management from indigenous communities is, I think, maybe I'll get this right, 80% of the forests under indigenous communities, or under indigenous communities where forest protection is occurring. So I think we have a lot as a global community to learn by putting our trust, and we come back to that trust issue, and working through some of these issues together. So maybe it would be, so in the case of when Taina was gazetted, there's a very much a core area that's set aside for conservation, and then areas of development where we can support communities to be having a livelihood out with the forest or connected to the forest, but not at a detriment to the forest. And I think studies have shown that these kind of payment for ecosystem services approach is successful for forest conservation. So right now, what that looks like at GRACE at this current point of time is employment. So we're a large employer of the area. We have about 40 people employed in our sanctuary and another 40 through our monitoring protection work in the forest. But yeah, it's a huge challenge. But I think if we don't put people in the equation, we weren't all part of the solution for conservation. We're unlikely to succeed.
Do you think that that word, going back to that word trust, do you think it's played out differently there because of the fact that these are all Congolese that are working at Grace? It's not a bunch of white faces coming in and saying, oh, you need to protect this land. You know, in the long run, you'll be better off. Like, you know, I'm somehow know more than you do about the place you've been born and raised in. And the fact that it's your staff, and I assume most of the staff is from that area or
from all the region.
So is that trust factor? I don't mean this to sound like a rhetorical question, but is that trust factor enhanced because you have people looking at one another and looking, they look like each other? You know, it's like when somebody from Grace goes to there and talks about forest conservation, they recognize that person.
Quite possibly. I think definitely the way that we work with decision making. You know, I think I see our role as an international organization to provide the tools, to provide the information and the support, and the decision making occurs to a certain extent in collaboration with the community. We have a lot of community meetings. So a lot of meetings, maybe to talk about like the process of how we work. So for example, to be able to do the survey in the area, that was a whole lot of meetings beforehand to be able to build support. So from our point of view, it's like, we'd like to know how many, we'd like to help you with protection of your forest, which you're charged with the protection. The first step is we need to know how many gorillas are gorillas still present in that area. In order to be able to do this, we need to have access to the entire forest. We would want to hire teams. This is the team members that would be required. And this is what it would look like. And this could be presented to the communities over a series of meetings for discussion. And so each community meeting is like 100 people, which would be representatives from each of the 21 families. And there we would talk. They would take it back, that 4-day track. Then they come back again, and talk about the next level and, who would be hired and building trust within that dispersed community there too. And, a series of meetings over a series of years, Jerry. And as you mentioned, Ebola, you know, put a pay to some of this work. We had 18 months. It came within 10 kilometers of the sanctuary. Obviously limited in our outreach during that time. We had a period before that of insecurity where it was hard to focus on anything beyond day to day. And then at the end of February, we had in 2020, there was a community meeting and everybody said, yes, let's do this. And then we all know what happened in March 2020, the whole world shut down. And we're like, okay, we stop again. We've stopped before. It's okay. We stop. And then that communication came back to us in June. No, the community said, we're not stopping. We've stopped from insecurity. We've stopped from Ebola. We're going forward. And so we're like, okay, how do we do this? Because we had planned to have our expatriate scientists visit to run training to help with this. But we had discussions and we were like, well, you know what, Katie, I was just thinking, we've just done remote teaching for the last 3 months. Let's make this work. And so through remote Zoom calls, we invested heavily in our internet infrastructure. But initially, we had to travel to cities to download the video files. We held tutorials with the team leaders, who then meticulously trained. We maintained all COVID biosecurity protocols with the quarantine periods and the way that we were contacting people and communities throughout the reserve. And over the last 4 months of 2020, a survey was conducted throughout the whole of Taita Nature Reserve. 200 kilometers transects were walked by these teams. And so I think that's a good example of how we work together to problem solve and set goals for moving forward. So I think a lot of what we really do as well is listening. So a lot of listening to the community, trying to understand. I think another thing that's really important is expectations. You say we're just this small conservation organization is really important with expectation setting. The needs are great. And so a lot of what we do is really managing expectations as well.
I'm really glad you brought that word up, because that seems to be many of the places that I've filmed and worked over the years, and we as an organization have been and working, is setting realistic expectations. It's so critical, because there's a history of conservation groups and organizations coming in and dumping a lot of money on a place. And so it's kind of seen, well, these foreigners are going to come, and they come with money. They come with stuff, and they're going to leave all their stuff with us. And it feels like you're almost immediately set up to disappoint people, because they're not going to get jobs. They're not going to get money. They're not going to get, you know, stuff. And it's just that long-term process that just seems so critical to set an expectation that this is, takes time, and there will be reward over the long run.
And Jane, you're right. I mean, we say this all the time at Grace. We're in it for the long haul. And I think, you know, the community knows that because of the history of being there. And we know we can't move anywhere because we've got 14 gorillas to care for. So we're not a project in terms of, like, we have funding for the next 18 months to get this done. We're really digging in deep, building relations which will last for a long time. I think one of the things that we struggle with, and that we it's top on our priority, is building the capacity of our staff. So when we have that long term approach, we invest heavily. Well, when I say we struggle with, I should say it's something that's top of our mind all the time, is how to train our staff, how to provide them opportunities for growth and leadership in the work that we do at Grace. So I think I mentioned to you before we came on the podcast, one of the greatest assets, I think, to Grace is this amazing team of advisors that we have all over the world that support the team. We do a lot. My role is coordinating a lot of that technical support, Zoom calls, follow-up, in-person meetings when we can. But it is, we kind of touched on, very difficult to access this area. It's the long-term relationships our advisors have with our staff, and that have been built over the time as well, which I think are very key to our success. We have one piece we haven't talked about a lot is our education programs and our community engagement teams. Where I was just in the last week, we had a meeting. We recently hired new staff. And the staff that have been with Grace for the last 10 years were trained and now led the training of the new staff. And so seeing that next generation taking that next leap, and Grace staff moving on to that role of advisors for others, was a defining moment, I think, for growth at Grace.
What do you think you have done at Grace with your staff that you have that you have the staff that has stayed with you all this time? And through some, it's really hard to explain to people how remote you are and how difficult this part of the world is to work in. I, you know, before we came on, we were talking about the fact that twice we had scheduled times to go to Grace and do filming and do some training of staff there in how to do, you know, better filming and all that. And we've had to cancel because of outbreaks of violence or, you know, disease or whatever it happens to be. And it's what is so impressive about what Grace has done is it's managed to survive. It's managed. It's still there. It started and it still exists. And it's managed to find and innovate ways to function. Like you said, you're doing a lot more with Zoom calls. You're based now in the United States, you know. A decade or more ago, you would have had to be based there. You know, as the program manager, you would have been based there, but you're able to work here and then work with a counterpart there. Going back to my question is, what do you think you have done at Grace that has kept that staff there and kept them engaged and motivated to not You know, because a lot of sanctuaries have a huge turnover in staff.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And you have not. You seem to have had, you know, the staff that stayed around. And like you said, now you have a new generation coming in.
I don't know. I mean, I've come into Grace relatively recently myself. Well, the last 3 years I've been involved with Grace. I think there's huge investment in our staff, in training on site when that's been possible, but also just like continuous communication, working together from our, you know, from the staff here on the US side, from the board here on the US side. I just think there's a great sense of community, despite the fact that we're all very remote from each other. I think I'd like to think that the staff take great pride in their work. They should be very proud of everything that they achieve and continue to achieve. I think they're real leaders in their community. We've seen that with our education staff, taking on roles within the community field for leadership. And I think going back to that expectations thing, we meet the expectations that are set. I think the organization is dependable. I think people have been able to grow in their positions, to learn new skills, to feel valued. And I think it gives like an oasis of hope in this area that is so violent and volatile. It gives something to focus on. It's a positive story. It's a success. And I don't know, someone said, I think success builds success. And I think that success of Grace is felt in ripples throughout the community. Just we had a program in our education program linked through LA Zoo, linking schools in the communities where we work with schools in communities in Los Angeles. And the response that we got from our kids, the parents from the communities around Grace was, you know, thank you for letting our students be known. So I think that opportunity to interact on a global level and to have that global connection is empowering for communities too. But particularly given the remoteness and the political volatility and violence in the area they're living. They have no choice where they live.
It seems like most of what Grace is becoming is less rehab work with gorillas and more conservation work. And especially if these 14 gorillas, and fingers crossed that no more show up, these 14 could take down the back fence and they could go off into the forest and live as a troop. If that happened, what does Grace continue to look like?
You're absolutely right, Jerry, that our focus is moving into a broader conservation focus. But I think that's due to, you know, our 10 years building the sanctuary. I think, as I mentioned before, that focus on success, the news for the gorillas in the wild was just devastating, the collapse of numbers. And I think we really felt like a moral obligation being based there next to the wild gorilla habitat to expand our operations to conservation. Now, Jerry, we would all love just to take down that fence and let the gorillas into Tai'in and nature reserves, but there's these things called the IUCN reintroduction guidelines. And one of the things that's really strong is the precautionary principle, which is do no harm to wild gorilla population. So our survey showed that there really are substantial wild gorilla populations in Tai'in. So our first duty of care and conservation should be to the protection of that population. And the risk of release of the sanctuary gorillas is they've been in human contact. They've been in, they've come from many different areas. They may have disease risks associated with releasing them into an area where there's existing, not just gorillas, but great apes. So that's one of the challenges for identifying a release site. I think in the Eastern DRC, you need to have that good protection, but also the presence of other gorillas. Those gorillas' conservation takes precedent.
Katie, what kind of numbers of gorillas are in there in the wild? And also, there's chimpanzees in there, right?
Yeah, like China's got a huge host of biodiversity with the gorilla, the gorillas, chimpanzees. We found in a carpet footprint, historic range of elephant, many, many different primate species. It's a very varied forest because it goes from kind of a higher altitude down into that lowland basin. So it's kind of the edges, just on the edge of the Albertine Rift kind of landscape. And so when we're looking at gorillas, everybody wants to know a number. The survey doesn't really give you a number. It's more like a benchmark for monitoring over time. If we go back to poop, gorilla poop, that's how ideally we'd like to identify numbers over time, is by collecting fecal samples and running DNA analysis so that we can get like a genetic numbers on the population. But we reckon probably between 150 to 300 gorillas are just within the Taina Nature Reserve.
Wow. Well, that's a significant number when you think 6,800 for the whole of Eastern Congo.
Yeah,
that's a really significant number. Wow. And what's any sense of the chimpanzee numbers?
Not so much on the chimpanzees. I'm not so sure. It's a bit more difficult to extrapolate our result for their numbers, but they're much more widespread throughout the reserve. So we had more observations of chimpanzees through the reserve.
People have asked me, especially when I've come back from that region, they've often asked me how important it is from a biodiversity standpoint. And I said, you know, if you're going to sort of triage saving primates on this planet, that's one of those places that you would just say, yeah, we have to protect. There's just so much biodiversity there. And when you think about the chimp numbers, the mountain gorillas, the grower gorillas, the everything, that whole Eastern Congo sweeping up towards the Albertine Rift is... I mean, you couldn't pick a much more important place on the planet.
Absolutely. And then I think also the other thing, you know, being part of that huge Congo Basin is such an important carbon sink. So as we move into this, you know, the decisive decade where we're going to decide on climate, decide on biodiversity, I think if we can't make it work here, we have to be, you know, the challenge is here. We can't be put off by the difficulties of the remoteness and this. This is the key area. We have to find a solution. Otherwise, it'll go. It'll be gone. And I feel confident in that success today. We can continue to build upon it.
I wanted to ask you, kind of conclude with, what does victory look like in grace terms? What does success look like? Because I always want to ask that question because I think so often in these conservation efforts, we get in because there's a problem. We see an issue that we're trying to solve. And we get so caught up in it that we sort of forget what the exit strategy is. Mm-hmm. You know, if you went and you asked some of the biggest conservation groups around the planet, I don't think they even could tell you what their exit strategy, mm-hmm. which is a success strategy. It's like, if we did everything right and we, quote, won, we would be out of business. But they never see themselves going out of business, for better or worse. But if you don't have that as a goal, there's a finish line down there, that long-termness that we talked about. That seems like that's why you have that goal. Here's what we long-term want to do. Yeah. So what does that success look like for Grace?
So I think, you know, long-term, that goal is coming up with a model for community-led conservation, where gorillas are protected, the forests are protected, and the people are benefiting. And you know, people, we talk about people benefiting. The communities there, it's just to make that meet their basic everyday need. Clean water, housing, medicine. If those basic needs can be met and the forest can be preserved, I think the mountain for that goal is looking at that mechanism for sustainability. So looking at how do we come up with sustainable finance. So finance is ongoing to be able to support this model. So that's when we look at the big mountain of our goal. And I think we need to just break that down into small little hills. And we do it one step at a time as we move towards that goal, because it can become all overwhelming. We just have to listen to the news. There's no good news stories for conservation, or few, we should say. So I think we've just got to keep listening to the communities, working hand in hand to do steps to move forward towards this community-led conservation where people and gorillas are thriving.
Do you feel that in that direction, is your staff, I guess you might call them senior staff that's there on the ground at Grace, are they in a position that they are generating those ideas? Do you see ideas coming out of them for how to expand?
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the other ways of capacity building is, you know, going to these international conferences and networks and learning, seeing examples elsewhere and being able, I think there's two things that come from these trips is, one, you see examples elsewhere, but I think our staff are also building their confidence that they are a solution too, and that they have a lot to offer to other conservation projects on how we work and what they've succeeded with at Grace. And then, Jerry, we were talking a lot about radio just before we came on, and community radio. And I think the education component of what we do for the local communities is so important for them to understand some of these conservation issues. So during COVID, our radio campaign focused on hygiene, healthy forests, healthy rivers, healthy people, very basic on hand washing, and how that could, you know, the impact that can have, not just on what we look for, not just on human health, but also for gorilla health and gorilla protection. Then our more recent kind of built on that, healthy gorillas, healthy forests. We're talking more about global climate and trying to understand if, you know, one of the big potential sources of that sustainable financing is through carbon. So trying to share the knowledge with the communities, with the leaders in these communities, with through our staff about these hugely complicated mechanisms, but that could be hugely beneficial to these communities. So I think a lot is making sure that our teams have the knowledge that they need and the tools that they need, and the training in problem solving to come. And definitely, a lot of these questions, I'm like, because I'd love our team to be responding to them, because really they're the experts. And we're just like, I think of myself as like a scaffold behind it. Yes, I think the team really has leadership. We just want to be like the wind beneath their wings, to build the confidence to be able to move forward.
Do you think your staff there place and position globally? One of the things that we constantly face when we go out is getting people to even understand that, you know, they've grown up there and they've seen that forest, but having a sense that that forest is connected to the rest of a landscape and a planet is just often a completely foreign idea. But once that settles in, the uniqueness, and I think, you worked in Rwanda at Karasoki. I mean, I think Rwanda has done a brilliant job of connecting the entire population of that country to mountain gorillas now. There's a celebration of this thing. When I worked there in the late 80s and early 90s, the people just outside the forest didn't even know why we were there and that there were gorillas up there. You're like, why do you keep going in there? Why do all these white people go up in that forest? Well, there's these gorillas and they only exist here on the planet.
Yeah.
That was such a foreign concept. And now every school kid in Rwanda grows up understanding that uniqueness and so therefore pride. And that seems like that awareness is something that's so critical to share, especially now that we have the communication tools. I can't even imagine Grace functioning without the internet now.
Yeah, and we've got to grasp all those technologies as we can. And I think that, again, coming back to our education role and, you know, moving forward, the sanctuary of Idias, those gorillas are our ambassadors for gorillas in the wild. The work, and whether that's through visits directly to the gorillas or the programs that come through the radios or the training that people receive or share with through our different community engagement programs, I think, you know, that's really fundamental. And I think a big piece in, it's not just like the school kids, but really like the decision makers, keeping that knowledge going from that excitement you have as a child to really understanding the complexities and challenges and solutions as you become a conservation manager or policymaker is critical.
Have you seen, speaking of education, have you seen new people that are coming to Grace to work, for example? Have they, that they kind of knew about Grace? I keep thinking of Grace because you sit up on a hillside.
Yeah.
I keep thinking of Grace as the shiny place on the hillside for local people to go. Those are people who have jobs and they access the internet and they know the bigger world. And it's like you're kind of the shiny example of success sitting up on that hillside.
And I think a lone car going up and down that road too, sharing that. I do believe people know about Grace in the immediate community. And now by trying to expand our areas of operations to other zones around the Taina Nature Reserve, and then also with our work we're doing with the Osala Conservation Corridor to connect Taina to Maiko National Park. These are brand new communities where Grace has just last few months started to work, building. We're very keen to reflect on bringing what's worked for us so far at Grace and adapting that and working with our partner organizations there to understand the situation in Osala. Because these areas are remote. So we can sit here, Jerry, with our A4 piece of paper on the map and it's just, oh yeah, here. But that's not really the reality, is it? You know, here it is. But actually, you're like walking in the Lake District with my brother. So the shortcut is actually the long route. So I'll say, well, why don't we just go from here to there? And he's like, yeah, you can go from here to there, but it's going to take longer than if we go this long, long way around here where things are actually better. So the first time our team went for to visit the communities in Osala, that one of their first objectives was just to assess the conditions of the road. Was it even feasible to reach by road? They went by motorbike, 14 hours on a bathroom motorbike, because they weren't sure if the car would be able to get there. They weren't sure. And that was just to the edge by afterwards, there's a whole day's walk to reach the community that they wanted to.
And that was probably dry season.
Yeah, exactly.
the other great dilemma, dry season versus rainy season. So,
but then on a map, they're close to each other, you know? So you would think it would be, yeah. So understanding those logistical challenges and figuring them out. It was even interesting, the Osala, I don't know how much in the weeds you want to get down, but like the Osala community that we're working with, back in the colonial age, they thought they were too remote to reach. So they set up an administrative headquarters at the end of the road, which was actually within another community's land area. And to this date, that's where the community administration occurs. So even to work with this remote community, first contact is made at their administrative headquarters, which are within the territory of another community. And then it's several days walk. And that's the end of the road. And then a day's walk just to get there. And then it's several days walk from there to when I actually get out in the community. So a lot of problem solving, a lot of listening and understanding. But our teams are so excited to visit these areas. Yeah. And through the potential to bring conservation to these areas. Yeah. It's all really exciting. It's very exciting. No 2 days, no 2 hours are the same, Jerry.
That's fantastic. Well, speaking of listening and understanding, this has been wonderful. Thank you for sharing this time, and especially to start off World Gorilla Day. This has been, I hope people have gotten an understanding of it, of a, not only a new gorilla, but a new conservation effort around gorillas. But thank you so much for doing this and kicking off our season 3. I can't believe that. And happy World Gorilla Day to you.
Thank you very much, Joe. And thank you, Joey, for this opportunity, for everything that you do to share information about gorillas and great apes in general and conservation. So thank you.
A huge grower-sized thanks to Katie Fawcett for helping us celebrate World Gorilla Day and get this third season of Talking Apes off to a great start. I want to thank her for shedding some light on the rare and magnificent Grower's Gorilla. And also a huge shout out to everyone at GRACE, both in the Democratic Republic of Congo and internationally, for all the work they are doing to help save growers from extinction. You'll find a blog with beautiful photos of Grower's Gorillas on our website at talkingapes.org. And of course, links to the GRACE website and their amazing GoPro Gorilla Cam. You've been listening to Talking Apes. We're the podcast that gets to the heart of what's happening with and to apes like us. Our conversations are with folks from across this planet of apes, writers, researchers, conservationists, and scientists, all getting us closer to understanding who we are and why. Because ensuring the survival of the other four great apes is the only way we're going to ensure our own. I would like to thank assistant producer Demel Zaban and our entire Talking Apes team for all the work they are doing to bring this podcast to you. And for the third season now, I'd like to thank you, the donors and Patreon members who make Talking Apes successful in over 100 countries through your generous support and sharing of this podcast. If you appreciate what you're hearing on Talking Apes, consider being one of those supporters. Just visit our website at talkingapes.org. That's talkingapes.org. Finally, I would like to thank the dedicated folks on the front lines of great ape survival, like those at GRACE. We hope through 3 seasons of Talking Apes, we have been able to shed a light on the incredible selfless work you do every day to ensure great apes, primates, and their forest homes survive well into the future. I'm Jerry Ellis. Thanks for listening. And thanks for sharing with family and friends the Talking Apes podcast.